This is Liberation Radio.
Capitalism needs poverty.
A world run by a handful of greedy bankers and CEOs who nobody elected can't possibly last.
Whatever we could do, we're gonna do, especially in continuing to preserve this earth.
Each week, we bring you interviews, commentary, analysis, political developments, and struggles affecting workers throughout the country as a way to build the movement for socialism in the United States.
The revolution will be broadcast.
The only thing that will ever defeat racism will be the defeat of its parents, capitalism and imperialism.
Without smashing mass incarceration, working people of all nationalities cannot have justice.
Liberation Radio is brought to you by the Party for Socialism and Liberation.
Welcome to Liberation Radio. I'm your host, Sean Garcia. On this episode, we talk about the character of the new Israeli cabinet. We hear part two of the interview with Akbar Muhammad, international representative of the Nation of Islam. But first, we speak with Ivy Sa of the Party for Socialism and Liberation, who gives an eyewitness account of their experience at the May 9th celebration of Victory Day in Russia, commemorating the tremendous Soviet victory in 1945 and the sacrifices that ultimately led to the defeat of fascist Germany in World War II. You were just in Russia for 8 days, including during the Victory Day celebrations. Can you describe to our listeners what Victory Day is and what the atmosphere and scene at the celebrations were in 2015?
Yeah, so Victory Day is May 9th, which is the Soviet victory on the Eastern Front, which is basically when the Soviet troops defeated Hitler's army and kind of turned the tide of World War II, which is something that isn't taught a lot in the West and in Western textbooks. They kind of like to tell you that, you know, the U.S. and England won World War II and some allies helped, but they don't really talk about the Eastern Front. But May 9th was when the tides really turned in World War II, and it's a big celebration throughout the former Soviet Union, and particularly in Russia, where so many troops were lost. So every year there's a big celebration, and this year was particularly large because it was the 70th anniversary of that victory. And it started with a march that's called the Immortal Regiment, the Smertny Polk, which is something, it took place across the country in all the different cities. And people just got together into the streets and they marched with photos of loved ones who had died in the war. Like basically every family had lost somebody in the war. So there was hundreds of thousands of people in Moscow and thousands of people in other cities. So it was a pretty impressive march. And then there was marches by children and marches by active duty military members. And in Moscow, there was this big parade that showed different types of military equipment, which you guys may have seen on TV. And then in the city that I was in, which is Zhelezno-Dorozhny, people kind of flocked to a statue, which was a memorial to the Great Patriotic War, which is the Eastern Front War. And they all laid a bunch of flowers there. They walked around in the park, wished each other a happy Victory Day. And it was a very raw, very natural celebration. There's a lot of flowers and gifts being passed around between complete strangers. And in the evening, there were concerts and fireworks. And people just met each other and celebrated and talked about their families. And it was a very natural thing. And I mean, I think it was a very unique experience for me because going back to Russia every year, I've seen people become more and more hardened by capitalism. And this celebration was very different because everybody was just celebrating the fact that they're alive. So, like, they really let their guard down. And they just enjoyed the fact that fascism was defeated and that their loved ones helped do that. So people really shared that. Like, they cried together and they laughed together. And there's a lot of sadness and joy that was shared. And it was a really beautiful thing to take part in for me.
Mm. So speaking about that, what do you think are the effects that you see from the Western sanctions on ordinary people in Russia today?
I mean, as people on the left, it's always important for us to remember that, you know, when the West imposes sanctions on a country, ordinary people are their intended targets. So any effects that we see on ordinary people aren't accidental. So, I mean, Russia suffered a lot of inflation and continues to suffer a lot of inflation. Like, the rate was 16.4% in April, and that was pretty immense. The ruble fell really, really significantly. It's now worth like $55, I believe, which is, dollars worth 55 rubles, I believe. So it's pretty bad. So businesses were really quick to raise prices on goods, but obviously weren't so quick to raise wages because capitalism. So people are suffering a lot. They're having to choose, you know, what to buy. They're having a very serious deficit in what they can buy because of what's being traded and what isn't. So there's definitely a palpable difference, but people are definitely keeping their morale up. And there's also a lot of pressure on people to continue becoming involved in private business inside Russia, because ever since the USSR fell, like, that's been the message sent out to young people, that they should be studying business, that they should be starting their own businesses, and that that's the only way that they can survive. And in the face of sanctions, that's definitely like a very palpable thing too. There's a lot of people who are leaving their jobs and becoming entrepreneurs and freelancing and doing stuff like that, hoping that they can maybe make some more money.
Mm. You said that the morale is still high, Dill, and that leads into my next question. Do you get the sense that the sanctions are causing more of a sense of defiance or demoralization?
I mean, there's definitely a mix. When people are dealing with economic distress and loss, there's obviously a lot of sadness, there's a lot of demoralization, but at the same time, I think that, you know, as corrupt as certain elements of the Russian government are right now, and as problematic as the nature of Russian capitalism is right now, the strong anti-imperialist stance that the government takes, and therefore what's being put out in the media and was being told to people, that the nature of these sanctions and why they're happening and what the intentions of those Western capitalist countries are, gives people a very realistic view on it. So there's a lot of defiance that comes out of that, because Western imperialism is being rightly portrayed as the enemy here. It's being portrayed as somebody who is interested in resources that Russia has a right to. Is being portrayed as somebody who is demonizing the Russian government and Russian people individually. And so when you have an enemy like that set up for you, it's a lot easier to be angry rather than demoralized about the war that essentially that enemy is leading against you, which is what sanctions are.
Right. And, you know, I mean, it's obviously very different in Russia today than it was in 1945. And definitely different than it was in 1991. What's your sense of, you know, how most Russians feel about, you know, the Soviet Union now, almost, you know, 15 years later?
I mean, so there's definitely an increasing sense, not just in Russia but throughout the former Soviet Union, that things were a lot better under the Soviet Union than they are now. So, you know, people are starting to realize what they have gained with capitalism coming is by no means worth what they lost in terms of basic economic and social rights. Like, an example that I like to give is, you know, when the counter-revolution in Russia was becoming popular and, you know, the people were trying to take the perestroika further and they kept demanding more and more Western goods, for example, there was a big complaint among youth in the Soviet Union that, for example, they didn't have enough different jeans to choose from that they could buy in the store, right? And now, you know, the Soviet Union has fallen, and immediately in the 90s, young people in the Soviet Union had access to all these different jeans. But suddenly, they had their health care taken from them. You know, they had their right to free health care taken from them. They had their right to a free education taken from them. You know, they had their right to housing and a job taken from them. So they have these genes. Well, what are they going to do with them, you know? And I think that that stark difference between, you know, the superficial so-called rights and so-called goods that capitalism gives you and the real things that people actually need is being definitely felt, especially now, especially with these sanctions, where Russian capitalism hasn't really given people that much to survive on. And I think another thing to keep in mind is, like, as we look at the sanctions against Russia, as we look at the crisis in Ukraine, something that people in Russia and in Ukraine are sharing a lot of right now, and people throughout the Soviet Union, is this extreme, like, anguish and pain and lack of understanding about how all these different nations that used to genuinely be brothers and used to genuinely be together in this union and didn't have any sort of national hatred towards each other suddenly have this extreme nationalism gripping them and are being taught to hate each other. And that's definitely a huge problem. And I think that that's the most common sentiment among the average, like, Russian people that I encountered, was like, why is this happening? Like, I remember a time, especially, you know, my parents' generation, I remember a time when we all spoke each other's languages and we all, you know, went to school together and we did not have this nationalism fomented between us. And I think May 9th is a really big reminder, really, of what socialism was able to do for the world and was able to do for the people of the USSR and how it could bring them together to fight, you know, the greatest evil that was on Earth at the time. So, I think this year that was definitely remembered, especially with, you know, the boycott of the May 9th celebration by certain nations in the world, and that extreme, you know, cold, stark division that's being fomented by imperialism and by capitalism that was not present during the era of the Soviet Union. That's all being felt in stark contrast with the memory of that victory and the memory of that unity. So I think definitely, and, you know, if you look at the Gallup poll that was done, I believe, last year, definitely a lot of people believe that things were better in the Soviet Union because of those basic material rights that people had and that basic national unity, that internationalism that really connected people and allowed them to defeat fascism.
Thanks so much, Ivy.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're tuned in to Liberation Radio, and you can check us out on our website, liberationradio.org, on Facebook at facebook.com/Liberation Radio Show, and on Twitter at the handle Liberation Radio.
So we are here on Liberation Radio with Richard Becker, who, in addition to being an organizer with the Answer Coalition, is also the author of the book Israel, Palestine, and U.S. Empire. Mr. Becker, thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much for the invitation.
And so what we have seen here recently is that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has, after some time, been able to put together a government. Can you describe his new cabinet and governing majority?
Well, I'd like to say, first of all, that the way that Netanyahu prevailed in the election was in the last day. He made an appeal to the extreme right, to parties that are considered to be even more extreme right than his Likud party, by using references to such things as that Arab voters were coming out in huge quantities and huge amounts and in droves, and that they were coming to the polls being driven there by left-wing organizations. And, you know, this kind of terminology, a very racist, extremely racist terminology, was aimed at pulling voters from the other right-wing parties. And he succeeded in doing this to the extent that he won 30 seats out of 120 in the Knesset, and then was called upon by the president, as is the way that the Israeli government operates, to form a new government. And he had a certain amount of time to do that. And actually, he went up to less than 1 hour before that mandate expired and announced that they had formed a new government. And it's a government that has only 61 seats out of 120 in the Israeli Knesset, its parliament, and is made up of a number of, and they're all right-wing, some of them are religious extreme right-wing, some of them are secular extreme right-wing, parties. Netanyahu himself is holding on to the position of prime minister, and he's also holding on to the foreign minister position because he'd like to try to offer that to a politician, perhaps from what is considered the more liberal, although that I say that with great caution, parties to broaden his government. But his last minute deal was with a party that is called the Bayit Yahudi, and that means the Jewish Home Party. And this is a very extreme right-wing party, really a party whose leaders have almost openly called for genocide. In fact, they do openly call for genocide. So you have, for instance, its leader, Naftali Bennett, aspires to replace Netanyahu, and he was given the Ministry of Education and with that, additional funds and to process an agenda for everyone in the country, including the Palestinian population, which makes up about 20%, the kids have to learn to be Zionist, according to Naftali Bennett. The most outstanding figure in the government, the one that's gotten the most attention, is a woman named Ayelet Shaked, and she's been named the justice minister. And I'd like to quote something that she said last year when the war with Gaza, the latest war with Gaza, was just beginning. She said that the entire Palestinian people is the enemy, and she called for its destruction, quote, including its elderly and its women, its cities and its villages, its property and its infrastructure. So that's quite a statement. That's really a statement that calls for genocide. And she posted to her Facebook the writings of a former associate of Netanyahu and the wing of the Zionist movement that he comes from and his father came from. And she said this about the Palestinians. She said, actors in the war are those who incite in mosques, who write the murderous curricula for schools, who give shelter, who provide vehicles, and all those who honor and give them their support, them meaning the fighters, the Palestinian resistance fighters. She goes on, they are all enemy combatants, and their blood shall be on their heads. Now, this also includes the mothers of the martyrs who send them to hell with flowers and kisses. They should follow their sons. Nothing would be more just. They should go, as should go the physical homes in which they raised the snakes. Otherwise, more little snakes will be raised there. Those are the words quoted by the person who is the new minister of justice in Netanyahu's latest government. And so we have, for all those who have retain any illusions about Israel being a democratic country or a democratic society or an inclusive society, the fact that you could have your minister of justice, the equivalent of the attorney general of the country, making such genocidal statements is extremely revealing and condemnatory.
Wow. Well, those quotes certainly floored me, and I have to say it makes one wonder in terms of the next question I have. Is we saw also that the Vatican came out recognizing, at least in the sort of general abstract sense, that there should be a Palestinian state and that the PLO should be recognized as a government, not simply just an organization representing Palestinian people. So do you feel that the extreme right-wing character of this government is polarizing things in a way that will have positive results for the liberation struggle of Palestinians?
Well, it's hard to say because there are also very serious issues right now inside the Palestinian Authority and a lot of opposition to the authority from people in the West Bank, from Palestinians in the West Bank and in Gaza and inside the 1948 borders of Israel, because the Palestinian Authority, from their point of view, has played a negative role by taking on security cooperation with the Israeli state. But that being said, it's clear that that the Palestinians are being offered nothing. I mean, one of the other things that Netanyahu did in the last day before the election was to say there will never be a Palestinian state under my watch. And that was, again, part of the appeal to the even more extreme right-wing parties, to their voters, to help win the election. Then as soon as that was over, he said, oh, I didn't really, you know, I'm really for a Palestinian state. That's to appease Washington. But for the Palestinians, including the, you know, and the population, you should say that the population, if you take together what was the British Mandate of Palestine up until 1948, in other words, the British colony, and that was Gaza, the West Bank, the Golan Heights, and what constitutes the 1948, Israel inside its 1948 borders, the populations are about equivalent now between Palestinians and Jewish Israelis. And so you have a situation where what exists for the Palestinians is continued occupation, including of Gaza, and an apartheid system. No apartheid system can last forever. They may seem strong, but, you know, I think that history has shown that this kind of apartheid system, whether it was apartheid in South Africa or in Namibia or in Rhodesia or in the United States of America, the people will not accept that forever. And the fact is that more and more countries in the world, including governments, are moving to recognize a Palestinian state. That may not be what the Palestinians fully aspire to, but it's a sign that Israel has grown more and more isolated in the world. It's really, its ally is the United States. It has other allies in some of the reactionary monarchies in the Arab world. But really, the only ally it can really count on is the U.S. government.
And there has actually been some backlash here. I mean, we've seen growth in the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, both in America and across Europe, perhaps more pronounced in Europe. And there has been backlash recently by those who accuse that movement of being anti-Semitic. How do you respond to that?
Well, of course, those criticisms are ridiculous. And this is the first line of defense that the supporters, the all-out supporters of Israel, have always used against any criticism of the Israeli state. And, you know, they claim they're trying to delegitimize. This is what the supporters of Israel say, that BDS is aimed at delegitimizing the Israel as a state. Well, if a state practices apartheid, should it be considered a legitimate state? That's a question I think that has to be raised. I don't think so. But they feel very threatened by this movement because they see a parallel to what was another apartheid state. Although I have to say that the apartheid system in South Africa was meant to subjugate the black workers and to super exploit them, whereas it has a different purpose in Palestine. It's really to force the Palestinians out. But nevertheless, they see a historical precedent in the role of the international campaign in isolating South Africa while the apartheid system still existed and helping to bring down that system. Of course, it wasn't the main factor. The main factor was the struggle of the South African people themselves. But the BDS movement was an important one, and the supporters of Israel see a parallel to the end of apartheid in the ending of apartheid as a legal system in South Africa, and what the future holds for the state of Israel as an apartheid state itself.
Well, excellent analysis there, and certainly I know that we can get more of that on frequent occasion at liberationnews.org. And so for Liberation Radio, again, I'm Eugene Perrier. We were joined here by Mr. Richard Becker, the Western Regional Coordinator of the Answer Coalition and author of Israel, Palestine, and the U.S. Empire, a book available via PSL Publications. Once again, Mr. Becker, thank you for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
All right, take care.
I didn't sleep all night. They allowed me to bring a book in that I was reading the Manning Marvel's book on Malcolm X, and I stayed up all night. Before we went to jail, Philip called a young man, because in Guyana, you know, people have to bring you stuff in jail, and he brought us some water.
So there's no water unless someone brings it on the
outside. Yeah. Well, in this particular prison, they said that water, so they brought some water, but they arrested him also. So three of us went to jail that night. And the next morning, I'm in the cell, and then they get a call, and I'm released. and the nature was to call the Minister Farrakhan, the conversation that the president had. And quite naturally, the press was all over it and so forth. That is the backdrop. And then quite naturally, the next day after I was released, I went to my hotel, got my clothes, and I left Guyana. And I said to myself, as that plane took off from Guyana, I said, I'll probably never see this country again in my life. And I've learned in traveling the world, never say never. And so I got back to America and told the story, the final call, and a few of the black papers covered it. So I got a lawyer, and we wanted an apology first. And then we wanted compensation for what they did to me. And so I began to fight this battle, and it's been now 4 years. I went back when they changed presidents, mm-hmm. and the same party went into office, and Donald Ramata became the president, the new president. And I must say, my meeting with him was a very good meeting. I met with him late at night for about 2 hours, just him and I. Told him about my case, and we talked about history, you know, my passion for history, and I was going over the history of Guyana, and he gave me a book by Chetty Jagan, very well known, called The West on Trial. And I really enjoyed that book, especially the part about the rebellion of the slaves and the Indian black relationship there. And I thought that perhaps President Ramata and I would work out first an apology, okay? Because people tend to believe what they read, and they believe the first story. Even if there's a retraction, they never see it. And my reputation for 55 years of my life working on behalf of the Nation of Islam and black people across this country would be involved, that I would be involved in terrorism and drugs. So I'm just giving you, that's the backdrop mm-hmm. of what happened, and we can bring it on up to date.
And so what is the current status of the legal case? What has sort of been the route it's taken, and where is it now?
Well, I have a lawyer here in America and a lawyer in Guyana. The lawyer in Guyana has been pushing for a court date to settle it. When I was there recently, not the last time, but before that, they had put a story in the paper that the case had been settled, which was a total distortion of the facts. The case had not been settled. And so my lawyer has been pushing for a date. They have an upcoming election on May the 11th, in a few weeks. And the opposition party that is predominantly an African Guyanese party are looking to take power if this election is free and fair. And they have been encouraging me to settle this problem with the Indian-dominated government.
That's all for Liberation Radio. I'm Sean Garcia. Please remember, this program is available free for broadcast by community and public radio stations. You can encourage your local radio station to air Liberation Radio. They can visit liberationradio.org for details. And again, tune in next week for more from The Struggle for Justice.